that was the main slide, James. If you go on to the next slide, which is why are we excited? I think, you know, there's a lot of us in education who are looking at all this kind of Web 2.0 stuff and getting all excited and blogging about it and stuff. And you might think, why is that? And I think one of the things that's really interesting to see the kind of enthusiasm that people have taken to this stuff. And I think we kind of look at them with a degree of envy, think if only they'd be that enthusiastic about using things like VLEs and so on. And another element is the kind of stickability. You know, people keep coming back to Facebook, MySpace, Flickr, whatever. And again, with a kind of a relish that they don't do for a lot of educational systems. And ease of use, you know, my dad could probably put photos up on Flickr. You know, there's a really kind of low threshold to participation, which again isn't always seen in educational systems. And lastly, we've kind of, for years, we've been getting excited about communities of practice, but they're actually really hard things to foster, particularly in kind of formal education. And here we see communities like, for instance, the open source programming communities that really work, or even if it's just around bands or interests in MySpace or something, you see communities that kind of really come together and work. So I think for all these reasons, it's kind of, we see all this stuff happening in Web 2.0, and we think we'd like a bit of that in education. So if you go on to the next slide, James, you should have a picture. To me, this is kind of what Web 2.0 feels like. It's fun, it's exciting, it's interesting. You kind of want to be there. And if you go on to the next slide, James, this is kind of what higher education feels like sometimes. It's kind of worthy and stuff, but not particularly fun. So next slide, James. So Web 2.0 characteristics. I've got a kind of general rule. If in doubt, stick a triangle in. I don't think this triangle actually means anything, but it's a triangle, so it works. So what are the characteristics of Web 2.0? Technology is obviously based around lots of technology and a big array of technology as well. You kind of collect things yourself. So for instance, I'm a Twitter user, but somebody else may use JQ or Pounce, whatever. You know, there's lots of, you kind of amass this technology yourself. Obviously the user generated content thing is a big thing. So, you know, Flickr, Wikipedia, those kind of things. So lots of content coming from a wide range of users. And learning where it does take place is kind of very informal and not structured. So I think open source developer communities are a good example there, where lots of developers pick things up by watching what the other people do in those communities. So down on the bottom left, we've got democracy. I think this kind of democratization of the process is really important in Web 2.0. Anyone can partake. You don't have to go through training or be formally approved. So anyone can contribute. Which leads on to the next point. It's kind of, it's really about bottom-up stuff. So we remove all the filters to participation. Anyone can publish anything and put anything up. There's no kind of top-down process involved. And obviously they're kind of very socially oriented. So it's just the social unit is the important thing, not the individual. So they're all kind of built around communities and connection, making connections with other people. And over on the right, you've got the kind of Tim O'Reilly stuff. So the idea of web as platform and stuff that's kind of delivered through the web. And this idea that you harness the collective intelligence, and that seems to be a really key principle, and you set your sites up to encourage its participation. That's the most important thing you can do for sites, to encourage that participation. And the last one's kind of a techie one, but it's quite significant as well. It's this idea of being in perpetual beta. You know, traditional software goes through, whatever, a release every 6 months, and this is the big update and stuff, whereas this, the Web 2.0 stuff seems to be just, you know, here's a new feature, if you like it, we'll keep it in, if not, we'll take it off. So it kind of just evolves as we go along. Then if we go on to the next slide, please, the higher education characteristics. Now, you may want to argue about some of these and we can have a debate, but just for the sake of contrast, I've put some up here. So at the top, we have very kind of controlled technology in higher ed. So, you know, I think the VLE is the prime example of that. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. There's reasons why we do that. It allows us to provide kind of a level of support, you know exactly what system people are using, and has us to kind of guarantee a certain student interaction, a certain student experience and quality of provision. So there are reasons why you do that, but it is kind of very centralized system. And in contrast to user-generated content, we have us-generated content, so it's, you know, academic papers and books and things that are generated by the people at the top of the hierarchy or further up the hierarchy. And whereas we had informal learning, it's kind of all based around accredited learning. We teach the people, and at the end we give them a test to test their knowledge, and that's, they kind of get the certificate, so they know that. So down in the bottom left is the perhaps the more contentious stuff. There is a kind of we know best attitude, and that's why we're teachers and why they're students, you know, that we think this is the best way to learn a subject, which is in marked contrast to how things happen in Web 2.0 areas. Everybody knows best, or the group knows best in a way, the collective intelligence knows best. And whereas the other one was bottom up, this is kind of very top down, so, you know, we tend to have agreed publications, the kind of hierarchy, professors, lecturers and stuff. And it's based around very much around individual achievement. You know, even though we have collaborative work, we value that. You know, it's the individual we assess at the end. And so then over on the right is a kind of all variations on a theme, really. David Weinberger talks about filtering on the way in, filtering on the way out. What Web 2.0 does is filter on the way out, so it's kind of this democratic process. Anyone can publish anything. But then what we do is, for instance, if everyone can become a blogger, you use things like the Technorati authority rating to determine who's a good blogger and who's not. So these are kind of new metrics. But in higher education, we tend to filter the way into a peer review process, so any good stuff gets published. So we review stuff before we release it, and that applies to software as well. We're going to have this perpetual beta. So you end up with this kind of filtered intelligence coming through to you. And it seems to be we often try and aim for perfection. You know, I think you see that particularly in software, you know. We'll come up with a massive functional specification and design the ultimate system instead of just kind of releasing stuff on a continual basis. So on to the next slide. Just a quick sum up of the implications of this, I think. There's a number of areas. Technology, so you have this idea of loosely coupled systems. You know, I've got my blog, I've got Twitter, I've got Facebook, I've got all these kind of things that kind of loosely come together, or a very centralized system such as VLE. And there are pros and cons to both those approaches. I'm not suggesting one's better than another, but they are a tension. And it's user-generated content versus academically produced content. Pedagogy, you know, kind of very informal, community-based versus, and I know we're kind of, there's lots of different things happening in higher education that can be very constructivist, but you know, an awful lot of education is still about the lectures. And it's at least very structured, you know, even in a very constructivist course, you still want to cut some kind of structure. Content and resource, so in Web 2.0 you've got these kind of new metrics, the technology rating or whatever, for determining stuff. A lot of third-party material and mixing, mashing up material, and new formats as well, you know, podcasts, video and stuff. Versus in, you know, traditional higher education, the stuff you know, tends to be articles, lectures and so on. And lastly, philosophy. I think the kind of philosophy of the two would probably best summed up as, you know, bottom-up versus top-down, really. And that's kind of, that's quite a fundamental change to how you go about viewing content. Okay, if we move on to the next slide. There's two things I want to talk about here that are kind of a result of the digitization of content and the kind of global distribution. And first I've kind of called the granularity of learning. So there's this quote from David Weinberger there. He says, you know, we thought that the album, the CD, was the kind of artistic unit for music, but actually that was a result of economic reasons that when you produced them, you packaged them, you distributed them, it made sense for them to be that kind of size. But as soon as it went online, then we learned that actually the natural unit of music was the track, and people create their playlists in iTunes and stuff. So I just wonder whether we have similar assumptions that we don't even know are assumptions about education and learning. We tend to think of the course, the undergraduate course, as the kind of the basic granularity of learning. But perhaps that's just a function of economics as well. You know, we need people to come to a campus, they need to stay there a certain amount of time, it makes sense to keep them there, we've got lectures, you want to, you know, examinations and accreditation costs money, so you want to bundle stuff up into a reasonable size. So what if there's a different granularity? Maybe it's a blog post, but I think actually the last point, which is not that there's one granularity, it's that there might be many granularities, so it's a 5-minute course, for want of a better word, up to, you know, your 4-year PhD. Instead of trying to compress or stretch things to meet our kind of basic unit, we have a much wider variety. So, next slide. And I apologise to James, because he thinks this title is quite pretentious. I think it sounds like a prog rock album. The Topography of Formality. And similar to the last one, I think you think about how much we formalise learning. If you think of that as a kind of topography, you tend to have quite big peaks, you know, big chunks. You do an undergrad course, a master's course, like. But perhaps actual learning is a lot more distributed than that. It's flatter with shallower peaks. And so perhaps you can do lots of informal learning through social network and so on. Or perhaps you've just been studying a particular area or have an experience or something that you want to kind of then bring together into formal learning chunks. You know, so if you've been looking at the history of Sydney kind of in the 50s and 60s for a while, because you were interested in it, you must say, okay, now I want to wrap that experience up somehow and kind of make it formalised. And you wouldn't be well served in higher education for doing that. And the last point is kind of ironically, that is what we do as educators. For instance, I've been thinking about Web 2.0 and higher education and work on some projects in the area for a few months now, came to Macquarie. And what I'll do is I wrap that experience up into a recognised output, which is a conference paper, and James, I'm writing a book chapter. So that is a recognised output in our industry, but often not in other industries. So next slide. Perhaps skyscrapers is the wrong thing in the metaphor here. It should be sharp peaks. But you can also, this is the current formality. You can have these big peaks and the rest of it's very flat. And maybe it's more like this, more like an archipelago, or perhaps I think James preferred gently undulating hills, which I think is probably right as well. But you know, it's kind of flatter and more distributed topography is what we need. So on to the next slide, please, James. I should say threat to HE. Higher education has some similarities with content industries and some differences. We'll talk about differences in a minute. But it's interesting to look at the content industries and see what's happening to them. I think the music industry is the most interesting there. As some of you know, Radiohead recently released their album kind of online, and lots of other people doing this. They're just bypassing record companies completely, just taking them out of the question. And you begin to think, why do I need a record company if I've got this distribution market and Web 2.0 tools allow me to find other tracks that I like? So you know, the role that the record company performed has been taken out of the loop. So when faced with this threat, content industries have two responses, as I see. First is kind of finding ways of maintaining your traditional publisher model and just stamping down on anybody who dares to try and copy a farm and think. And the second one is just to accept that actually content will be free. That's just what's going to happen. And you need to find new business models that build and sell stuff around it. And you probably won't be surprised to hear that I'm kind of in the second camp. And I agree with Cory Doctorow, who says, you know, any business model that's based around restricting access to content is just plain dumb. So there are some similarities with content industries, but also some different things. On to the next slide, please, James. You can think of higher education as doing a few things. The first is research. I think that will kind of carry on. We need to do new places with this research and collaboration with big companies to do that research. Next slide. Another function was the storage of knowledge, kind of what's embodied by the library. And that's facing a big change, and libraries have been very kind of responsive there. But when information was bound up in the physical form, you had to come to the campus, then the library performed a particular role. But in a Google world, that role isn't the same. Certainly, I mean, there are other roles for the libraries, and lots of things do, but they need to reinvent themselves. And the last function is that of, is that of teaching. And in a world of iTunes U and Barclay, you've got a YouTube channel and stuff. You know, there's lots of other access to teaching material out there. And I'll come on to the next about what we do in addition to just teaching. But certainly we need to get away from the idea that people coming to us will be the sole providers of information for them. Okay, on to the next slide, please. I should say plus. What else does higher education offer? The social factor, you know, being able to come to a campus and study with other students is a big thing. Convenience, I think we kind of often underestimate this, but although I could go out and learn a subject on my own, actually having an expert in that subject bundled together a set of resources, a set of learning activities, with a cohort I can work through it with and give me a test at the end is actually a massive kind of convenient factor, and I'm willing to pay for that level of convenience. The next one is the kind of other side of teaching. It isn't just about giving information, it's about guidance and teaching people skills and guiding them through content as well. I think this is actually a big kind of selling point, but it's one that's quite hard to market, I think. I think often students think they want content, but actually what they want is what they need is guidance. And the last one is accreditation. Universities don't quite have a monopoly on accreditation, but certainly the degree is kind of the most widely recognised unit of accreditation. And I think if that was to be weakened, then some of the role of universities would be weakened. So, if you're still with me, on to the next slide, please. You're probably asking, what's learning design got to do with it? Okay, I want you to imagine that we have a big kind of set of user-generated learning designs, sequences, activities, whatever you want to call them. And I think it can help this, having set up this kind of culture clash between Web 2.0 and higher education, I think it can help bridge that gap in a number of ways. First is Meno's Paradox, or just sort of guidance, really, to hand you off of that support and guidance. So if you have these kind of learn activities, it allows people to still work through the structure and guidance through a set of resources, if you want, that they kind of really seem to like and appreciate, and don't just want to be left to the kind of anarchy of finding stuff out. The granularity of learning things that I talked about, I think blogs are a good analogy here. Before blogging, often the kind of the granularity of academic output was either the journal paper or the book, in a way. And as lots of academics start blogging, such as I have, find it really liberating in a way. You know, a blog can be anything from a blog post, from a sentence to, you know, a full-scale essay. So actually, we found a real kind of difference in granularity of academic output through that medium. So if we had a range of kind of user-generated sequences, you'd have them from, you know, little 5-minute things, learn this, to, again, through to kind of big proper courses. To reuse my topography of formality phrase again, you could really have lots of different types of things, lots of different areas you could tackle. So you could really get into the long tail of learning. So I mentioned if you wanted to do history of Sydney, or you wanted to look at football teams of the northeast or something, you know, you're not going to be well served in education at the moment. If there's lots of user-generated stuff, you can get in there and do that. So your people will really be able to wrap up their experience and their knowledge in lots of different ways. The kind of culture clash thing that I set up, I think this could be useful because it allows both the guidance and structure that we value in higher education, but also this level of user input that seems to be a key part of Web 2.0. The next one is Web 2.0 quality. You know, this is one of the things that often bothers us in higher education. We like to say, how do we know that what they'll be getting will be good quality stuff? I think at least here the focus is on the quality of the learning experience rather than the quality of the content. And you could plug different content in and out as you saw fit. But I think we do have to accept that, you know, different metrics would be required. It's not about us determining necessarily what's good. This is a good way to learn this, but actually other people may choose different methods to learn it. If it's good for them, then it's kind of fit for purpose. And the last one is personalization. So, you know, I mentioned you have a long tail of interest. So it's not only the subject you want, but also the way of learning. If you like learning collaboratively, then there's probably a collaborative option somewhere. So next slide, please. So I think in order for this to be true, we would need lots of things. First is kind of tools to generate and share what we might loosely term learning designs, such as LANs, but also lots of other things. We need a motivation to share, and cracking that is key, I think. We'd need some kind of widely recognised, easy alternative accreditation methods. Perhaps the key thing is you need a critical mass of stuff. You know, it's the same with the learning object repositories. Actually, 3,000 objects isn't enough when you want to try and find stuff. You need 300,000 or whatever. So getting that critical mass would be key. So what I kind of would like to envisage is a kind of flicker for learning design where anyone's putting this stuff up and they're sharing them and commenting on this stuff. So next slide, which is the last one. Or, you know, am I just wrong about this stuff? Is education or learning kind of just intrinsically different? You know, it's not meant to be fun, it's meant to be hard work, it's rewarding ultimately, but it's not fun necessarily. And should universities be the place that holds out against all this Web 2.0 nonsense and user-generated content? So I've got a quote there from Michael Gorman of Britannica, who's saying, a few academics endorse Wikipedia heartily. You know, education is not a matter of popularity or convenience, it's a matter of learning, of knowledge gained the hard way, and of respect for the human record. So a professor encouraged the use of Wikipedia as the intellectual equivalent of a dietitian who recommends a steady diet of Big Macs with everything. So I think that quote is one of those kind of dividing quotes. So you either makes you rant and rave and shout it, if it does with me, or if you find yourself sort of nodding in agreement with it, then you're probably, this slide is for you. Okay, that's the end of the talk. I can start video if you want me to. I don't know if you can call up the Skype where you are.
Take just one or two quick questions and I can type them in.
I don't know if you can see me. Respond. I'm not sitting here in my pyjamas, although I could do. It's like one of those bad dreams you have where you go to work in pyjamas, presenting in my pyjamas.
Has anyone got any brief questions that I can type in for Martin?
Thank you.
on the plus side for you, just can expand more on the benefits of the practical side. I'm not sure I've got this question, but I'll start talking and you can add more in if you want. Do you mean just practical as in doing stuff now by just taking and using Web 2.0 technologies and what? For instance, at the OU, we've started developing Facebook applications, and it's kind of really interesting once you do that, because you start thinking about stuff in a completely different way. It's much less about directed learning rather than trying to give students tools to facilitate their learning and their engagement with each other. So that's kind of really different from when you're in a VLE, kind of really direct stuff. So those are kind of a practical benefit. Oh, sorry, unis is more practice oriented. Okay, yeah. Well, I think that's definitely true. You know, if you have this flicker for learning designs, and some of those learning designs in there would be from organisations. You know, it's like, we need people who can do this stuff, who can know this stuff. I was going to say Cisco, but they're a bad example. They kind of have their own stuff already. But, you know, here's the uni part or the Ford one, and you could work through that stuff. So it allows people to kind of get a real focus on what, and trying to bridge that gap also between kind of vocational skills and higher educational skills. So I'm not sure who answered that question. I'll stop there otherwise. I'll just carry on.
If there's perhaps one more quick question.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for letting me present this thing. Good night. I'll go off to bed now. Good luck with the rest of the conference. Okay, I'm hanging up now. Bye. I'll chat to you later, James, maybe sometime. Bye.
Martin for staying up so late and being able to share that with us. He was hoping to be with us face-to-face, but timing worked out that he could only be here about a month ago instead of this month, and that was why we still wanted him to present rather than drop it all together. The next presentation is also a virtual presentation. This one's actually pre-recorded, though. Let me just